the Project Censored Show on the Morning Mix. Today, Peter Phillips, Andy Roth, and Abby Martin from Media Roots will address the questions of strategy for Occupy. Can a nonviolent social movement be effective and remain nonviolent in the face of a repressive empire? We'll be joined today by Dr. Cynthia Boaz, political science professor in nonviolent struggles at Sonoma State University, and rapper and activist Boot Riley with the Occupied Oakland Movement. And we will also hear from Steve Zeltzer, Workweek Radio Labor News, and round out the hour with Ted Rall, author of the Anti-American Manifesto, and Michael Nagler, former chairperson of the UC Berkeley Peace and Conflict Studies Program. Well, good morning. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. This is the Morning Mix. I'm Peter Phillips. Standing in for Mickey Huff, who's on vacation, is Andy Roth from Project Censored. And we have Abby Martin in studio from Media Roots. Today we'll address the question of strategy for Occupy. Can a nonviolent social movement be effective and remain nonviolent in the face of a repressive empire? But first, we have a song from singer and songwriter Vic Sadeau. Okay, well, Vic's warming up, so we'll get back to him. And so our first we have two people in studio with us is Boots Riley, who's with the Occupied Oakland, and online is Cynthia Boaz from Sonoma State Political Science Department. Abby, will you introduce Boots?
Yeah, absolutely. Boots Riley is a musician, vocalist, writer, and public speaker known for being the front person and producer of The Coup, as well as for Street Sweeper Social Club. The Occupy movement doesn't have a leader, but Oakland activist and rapper Boots Riley has been actively involved in Occupy Oakland since day one.
And this is Andy Roth. On the telephone line, I think we have Dr. Cynthia Boaz. Cynthia, are you there?
I'm here. Hey, good morning, guys.
Excellent. Dr. Boaz is a professor of political science at Sonoma State University. She specializes in political development, nonviolent conflict, and struggle. She researches political communication with an emphasis on media coverage of democracy struggles. She's the vice president of the Meta Center for Nonviolence and on the executive board of Project Censored and the Media Freedom Foundation.
Boots, this is Abby. I wanted to start off with just asking you a question. We've all heard that quote, those who make a peaceful revolution impossible make a violent revolution inevitable. We've seen that in the Arab Spring. And in the face of these federalized crackdowns, how can we move forward nonviolently to fight? I mean, we're facing the biggest military-industrial complex in the world.
Well, I think that the more important question is, how do we move forward? Because I believe that the debate over whether the Occupy Wall Street movement should remain nonviolent or is nonviolent, I think it's misguided, because nobody's attacking the police. Nobody's, setting firebombs on anything. But this is a misguided debate that actually, if you look at the emails that were leaked out by from Block by Block, the Block by Block group that's part of Gene Kwan's camp, and they were talking about trying to divide Occupy Oakland along those lines. And what you see from their further press release says is that they got a bunch of folks to move to Snow Park away from Occupy Oakland along the lines of saying we're the nonviolent ones, while at the same time that same group was organizing with the police to dismantle the Snow Park group. So what I'm saying is this, is that this, I think it's a good, healthy theoretical debate to talk about. However, I don't even think it's really a problem, Mm-hmm. I think that the real thing is that what we need to do is focus on doing actions that actually solidify working class unity while challenging the profit process in this system. And so things like strikes, work stoppages, and shutdowns are things that have been tools of an effective left for over a century, while at the same time, they are not considered nonviolent. I mean, Gandhi was against strikes because it physically keeps people out of their job site. And if you're going to have an effective strike, you have to physically keep scabs out. So the question is, what is violence and nonviolence? I think that's, you can say that's semantic, but I think that's important because what are we talking about here? Are the people that are saying that it should be nonviolent, saying that we shouldn't have strikes? If they're not saying that, then I don't have much of a problem with it. However, I think that since the only violence that has come up is a few broken windows, for that to be an issue that's keeping that keeps being said as the main issue going on, I think it I think it subverts the general message by it being, you know, so much in the forefront.
Dr. Boas, you've contributed a chapter to Censored 2012 on media distortions of nonviolent struggles, and one of the things you do early in that chapter is to give a kind of working definition of what you mean by strategic nonviolent conflict, and you specifically use that term conflict. I wonder if you could tell us some about why that specific terminology.
Well, it actually gets to the heart of what Boots was just talking about, which is that there's a general failure amongst, you know, the movement to identify the terms, to define the terms that we're using, specifically violence and nonviolence. And I think that there's actually a lot of misunderstanding. And so to start with, I'll just clarify that things like strikes and even more assertive tactics like nonviolent blockades, which is actually what Gandhi was opposed to. He wasn't opposed to strikes. Those things are still generally considered to be nonviolent. It's when there's an attempt to use tactics that will inflict some sort of harm, either physical or psychological, on the opponent that it becomes violent. And it's not just because there's, you know, because there's a moral issue in terms of using violence. It's not about, I mean, it is for some people, it's about, you know, principled stance against violence. But it's also because it's also important to use nonviolent tactics in a strategic way in a struggle like this, because it's about legitimacy and thinking about the future and the system that you're going to create next. And so it comes to a question of ends and means. And I think that activists really need to think carefully and strategically about the means that they're using and if those means are consistent with the ends. So, you know, one way of thinking about this would be to say that anything that's won through violent means has to be sustained through violent means. So, you know, I would then ask if there's anyone, you know, advocating or tolerating the use of any form of violence in a struggle for justice or for freedom or democracy, you really need to think about what sort of context you're creating for the system that comes next. And is it going to be any better than the one that it's replacing? And I think that it's very, very difficult to create legitimacy from a set of violent tactics. And if I can just say one more about, you know, the divide and conquer strategy that Boots mentioned about opponents of Occupy Oakland using against the movement. That is exactly the kind of strategy that the movement needs to be using against its opponents. You can't win a struggle using defensive tactics. You have to go on the offensive. And so what I think Occupy needs to be doing is identifying clear and achievable objectives in terms of the struggle, and then coming up with tactics that will help them to achieve those objectives. And some of those tactics, I think, should involve, you know, dividing what's called the pillars of support for the system in these different institutions like media and universities and businesses and ultimately even security forces to either win them over to their side of the struggle or at the very least neutralize them so that they don't have an incentive in fighting in a violent way the movement.
Cynthia Boots, I was wants to respond here.
So again, under the definitions that people are talking about, the only thing that happened was a few people broke some windows one day. In the midst of, you know, one the biggest class conscious action that has happened in recent history in the United States, the idea that then nonviolence versus violence becomes a, you know, huge part of the debate means that we are falling for, as opposed to those in academia and in people that are decidedly nonviolent, saying, okay, the question is, where do we go from here, and picking campaigns and coming and being part of it. I think that in reality, what we need to do is build a movement in which the entire left is able to be involved. And some of these debates are around, you know, so for instance, there's a lot of tactics on either side that I don't agree with. However, I think that all of those folks need to be involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement. Otherwise, then we start saying who can't be in it.
Right.
You don't see the right doing that. Even the people on the right who may be very extreme or somewhere in the middle, they're all unified. They're not arguing about which things. The point is that in order to make the Occupy Wall Street movement grow, and this is something that doesn't just come up in this debate. It comes up in almost every debate. People are taking things from a standpoint of, well, what I believe is the right way, and so everyone else needs to adhere to what I believe in, and that is that becomes a problem that leaves people out. And I'm not saying that talks like this shouldn't happen, but I think that the direction, the angle at which they're talked about as being how can we define this movement, I think that becomes a problem, and it keeps people on both sides away from the movement.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, sure, Cynthia.
I agree that the factionalizing within Occupy is totally overstated and probably largely manufactured by, you know, this false dichotomy that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, that being said, I would argue that you can't win with violent tactics, because I'll quote Hannah Arendt. She says that in a contest of violence versus violence, the state, I'm sorry, in a contest versus violence versus violence, the state is always supreme.
Well, what violent tactics are Occupy Oakland using?
Well, this is what I'm going to get to, is that I can't speak for everybody who's talking about nonviolent discipline within Occupy. But for myself, my main concern wasn't about the breaking of windows. It's more about some of the rhetoric that I've heard from frustrated and, I think, to some extent, desperate activists who are looking for, at this point, any means necessary to have a victory. And so it's really more about cautioning, you know, the movement in terms of going forward and thinking about strategically, how are we going to organize? You know, how do we think of ourselves as a movement? And I agree, bring people together, because unity is the most important criterion for an effective movement. But I think that's why we have to spread knowledge about the effectiveness of strategic nonviolent action, not as a way to impose, a theoretical belief or, you know, personal philosophy on everybody and so that they have to conform, but in order to really understand in a systematic way what is going to be the most effective way of getting a victory and what is going to be what kind of victory will produce the most opportunity for long-term legitimacy of a new system. And I just don't think that, granted I have a bias, but I don't think that you could do that in this day and age using violence. I think that by definition, the use of violence is the opposite of legitimacy, because it can force people to change their behavior, but it can't force them to change their mind. And what we're talking about is the changing of perspectives on a mass scale, a global scale. And so I guess, you know, violence is, in my view, it's divisive. It doesn't win people over. It alienates them. But back to your original question, Boots, which I think is important. Yeah, we have to identify what do we mean by violence and nonviolence. And that's something I can't really answer that. I think that's something that has to be worked out, you know, within the context of the movement's internal structure itself. But I do think there's a very clear line at some point between violence and not violence, and that has to be identified.
Two observations here, and maybe each of you, Cynthia and Boots, can respond to these. One is, listening to each of your comments, I'm struck by the need, and again, not to turn this into pure semantics, but that to say that one renounces violence is not to give up on the idea that one is actively resisting or engaging even in conflictual behavior. And so that's one observation. The other is that in terms of unity, I think that one of the factors we haven't talked a lot about yet is the role that the corporate media play in portraying events like Occupy Oakland, and how the corporate media in portraying those events frame them in ways that are potentially distorting of what's actually happening or the goals of the people involved.
And I'd like to say that, like, right here, when I say what are the things that the Occupy Wall Street movement have been doing that's violent, that somehow this is a big issue, yet we can't really name anything except rhetoric that people have heard said. Now, there are things that I really disagree with. People have showed up at Occupy Wall Street events and Occupy Oakland events with American flags. And I think American flags is violent rhetoric. That's my point. That's my point of view. I know everyone doesn't believe that, but it's a flag that's used to plant down for war and to claim land from, you know, from away from the people. So, but however, there are folks that, you know, claim to be nonviolent that are waving that flag at these. But the point is, I'm not going to get stuck on that. Right. That's not that's not what I'm going to get stuck on when we're trying to organize this mass movement. And we want this to be a mass movement. We don't want this to be only a few people who agree with this. So as far as the rhetoric that's coming in, we can't start talking about that exactly. But what we can talk about is what has been done and how has the media split. And this is media. We're in media right now. So how is the media spinning it? And from your bio, obviously, you know that the one thing that I just found out as I was researching the Montgomery bus boycott, the second day of the boycott, the newspaper, the mainstream newspaper, had a big article that focused on the idea that people were shooting at the bus drivers, that buses, windows were being broken and drivers were being targeted. Now, my question then is, should that at that point have kept people away from that movement?
You're listening to the voice of Boots Riley in conversation with Cynthia Boaz. He's just asked Cynthia a question. I'm Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio at KPFA. Cynthia, would you respond to that? We've only got a couple minutes left.
Sure.
And
sure. I just want, okay, quickly, I want to say that the problem with allowing for, like, anybody with any perspective, you know, advocating anything into the movement is that once you use violence in whatever form, you can't go back. You no longer have a nonviolent struggle. So there's, Michael Nagler might talk about this later, but there's an equation, which is that nonviolence plus violence equals violence. So that that's something that I think the movement has to think about very, very carefully. Like, there's no such thing as mixed strategies. And so in that sense, I guess I would say that there does need to be, you know, a clear line drawn. You know, Gandhi had a zero-tolerance policy. King had a zero-tolerance policy for violence. And it worked for them.
Actually, Gandhi was not the only person that made the Indian independence happen. There were militant movements happening for decades before he got there.
But, right? Okay, fair enough. But as a strategist, a nonviolent strategist whose theories and tactics have now been applied for almost 100 years since the Indian independence struggle. I think, you know, he clearly is, you know, considered to be the founding father of this field, this work. But back to what you were saying, a couple of things, Andy.
Cynthia, we're going to have to wrap this up.
Okay.
We're going to have.
What I would say is, no, we should. We have to be conscious of the fact that that media distorts civil resistance and nonviolent struggles, and largely that's because violence sells, and because there's a conflating in the public mind between the ideas of violence and power. Those two things should actually be made very distinctive, but you know, we tend to see a display of violence as a display of power when it's actually just the opposite. It's a sign of a feeling of a lack of power, and I also think that activist movements now in the day of social media need to take much more control of the narrative of their struggles to the greatest extent possible to try and counter the dominant media paradigm that comes out of mainstream and conventional media.
For people that want to follow up on this, Cynthia Boas has a chapter in the censored 2012 book entitled Media Distortion of Nonviolent Struggles, which is a very important thing. Boots, we really appreciate you coming in and talking about this as a conversation that needs to be addressed in a much broader way, I think, and certainly continue to deal with. And we're going to continue this conversation with Michael Nagler, who Cynthia knows very well, and Ted Rall, who is the author of the Anti-American Manifesto. And
I just like to say that I hope that people come down to Occupy Oakland. Don't worry about the criticism from outside of it. Get involved, because it's an open process, and the Occupy Wall Street movement is whoever's in it.
Thank you very much, and we're going to go quickly to Vic Sado for a song to wrap us up, and then we'll do the labor news.
Hey, thanks for having me, Peter. I got a song called Oh What a Day, which is it's a new song on my new CD, and it's I made a new video at YouTube. You can check that out. Just go to vicsado.com or vicsado at YouTube. After 8 years of Bush and Cheney, the country was weary in war. Yeah, W was Dick Slade O'Cheney, and the Constitution was torn. When these empire thugs used torture, they put our poor country to scorn. And as they looted the treasury, a mighty new movement was born. Yes, they left the country in ruin. They lied and made profits from war. They lied about all they were doing, from 9/11 to Iraq and more. Now the country's got Obama and Biden, and there's so much hope in the air. But trust in them will run out when they have no justice to share. Oh, what a day. What a wonderful jubilant day. Oh, what a day. When Bush and Cheney went away. Oh, what a day. What a wonderful jubilant day. Oh, what a day. When peace through justice is the way. It's not about the color of your skin, not looks, not personality. It's all about who you you are serving and the truth about your policy. It's really about exposing the lies that misled us before and stopping the wars they're imposing and serving justice once more. Now we got a new face for the empire, the good cops replacing the bad. And once again, there's blood on the wire. It's all so mad and so sad. They still use the lies of 9/11 to cover up all that is wrong. And they're still looting the treasury, but the movement for justice is strong. Oh, what a day. What a wonderful jubilant day. Oh, what a day when Obama and Biden go away. Oh, what a day. What a wonderful jubilant day. Oh, what a day when peace through justice is the way. Oh, what a day.
This is Abby Martin reporting for Project Censored. Announcement today at noon, the Occupy Santa Rosa movement and leaders in the local immigrant community will be coming together in Santa Rosa for a powerful action against Wells Fargo. The action is a collaboration between Grattan Day Labor Center, the Dream Alliance, Occupy Santa Rosa, the Committee for Immigrants' Rights, and MECHA. Our action starts at 12 p.m. in the Albertsons parking lot at the corner of Sebastopol Road and West Avenue in Santa Rosa. There will be a short rally with testimonies, cultural expression, and more. Then we'll march downtown to Wells Fargo and demand that they stop foreclosing on our homes and divest their money from private immigration detention centers. We need you to join us in this historic action for immigrants' rights and economic justice today at noon.
And you're listening to Project Censored show on the Morning Mix at KPFA. This, we're going to continue now our discussion on strategies for Occupy. Can a nonviolent social movement be effective and remain nonviolent in the face of a repressive empire, and or is a violent revolution necessary? And Andy, will you introduce our next guest?
Yeah, we have on the line both Ted Rall, who's a syndicated columnist, a syndicated political cartoonist, an opinion columnist, graphic novelist. His work has appeared in hundreds of publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post. His current book is the Anti-American Manifesto, published in 2010 by Seven Stories Press. Ted argues that America is headed for an economic and political collapse and that we need to intervene with a revolutionary movement. Our second guest in this half of the hour is Michael Nagler, who's devoted his life to exploring nonviolence as an alternative to war. He's professor emeritus of classics and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley, and a founder and former chairperson of the university's Peace and Conflict Studies program. He's become one of the world's most widely respected peace scholars and activists, and he's also the president of the Meta Center for Nonviolence based in Petaluma. So, Ted and Michael, are you each of you with us?
Yeah, hi, sir. This is Michael Nagler here.
Hi, Ted. Good to talk to you. This is Peter Phillips in studio here with Abby Martin and Andy Roth. You wrote your book, The Anti-American Manifesto. It came out in 2010. This was before the Occupy movement really emerged. And you said right in the beginning there that the government has become so undemocratic and unresponsive that the only reasonable means of opposing it is to strive for its violent overthrow. Are you still seeing that as viable, or do you think Occupied can step in and really make a change?
Well, I think that it's necessary more than it is viable. The government will not be overthrown without the use of violence. Occupy, on the other hand, is a nonviolent movement. And if Occupy is to metastasize into a revolutionary movement, it's going to need to remain nonviolent for the time being, for a considerable time, probably. You know, all revolutionary struggles in their infancy have to, in order to gain popular support and in order to grow and in order to not attract too much state repression, have to maintain a nonviolent character for much of the initial period. But as we've seen in Egypt with Tahrir Square, which was the main inspiration for the Occupy movement, it is very difficult in the end to close the deal and drive a repressive government from power without the use of violence. So I think that what we're really looking at is a movement that could become revolutionary in character or could inspire revolutionary movements, which I believe are required to overthrow this government before it falls apart and disintegrates into a post-Soviet 1990s Russia kind of scenario. But that we are going to need to go through a period of building up the numbers before we can even really contemplate violence as a tactic. I mean, no government, there has never been a nonviolent revolution. But that said, there has never been a revolutionary movement that did not, for much of its time, begin as a nonviolent movement.
Dr. Nagler, Andy Roth here. Can we have revolutionary change without violence?
I don't think there's such a thing as revolutionary change with violence. I think the only real revolution is the revolution against the violent values and the violent worldview that have created the system that we all loathe and that's gradually strangling us here on this planet. If the only real change is the change to nonviolence. And I would object, not can't agree, that there never was a nonviolent revolution. And I think the we had about a 95% nonviolent overthrow of the British Raj in India. And there have been other examples also that are not tripping off my tongue at the moment. The reason that Tahrir Square went violent was that its nonviolence was not mature enough. People, understandably, because nonviolent education is not available readily nowadays, understandably people didn't know that they needed to have a constructive program before they had the protest movements, and you know, they just didn't have enough training to do the strategy necessary. But I maintain that if Occupy stays nonviolent and expands and matures and deepens its nonviolence so that we have what Gandhi called a constructive program on the one side and what I call an obstructive program on the other, and that it's all mapped out strategically as to how we're going to advance with this thing, which is what we've been working on here at META, that will be the real revolution, and that will allow the prevailing system to kind of crumble in its wake.
Michael, Cornel West and Carl Dix had some long conversations here in Berkeley a few weeks ago, part of which was on C-SPAN this week. And Cornel West is saying, well, we're at the fork in a road. He's saying we can either go towards anger, revenge, and bigotry, or we can go towards love, justice, and equality. Is nonviolence, is that based in love, justice, and equality? And I'm ask you that, and then we'll get back to Ted and see if he thinks that we can have that and a revolution as well. Michael?
Yes, Philip. I believe that it is nonviolence, when properly understood, is definitely based in love and equality and the perception that all life is one. But we sometimes misunderstand love as just a sentimental phenomenon, and we don't understand that it involves the conversion of negative drives like anger. You have this marvelous statement by Martin Luther King that we did not lead to outbursts of anger in our movement. We roused anger and expressed anger under discipline for maximum effect. That's the part that people don't understand. So, yes, while I'm saying definitely it's based on love, but it's based on a mature, very deep spiritual unification and not just on the sentiment that we're presented with as a definition of love in the popular media. So if we could keep the foundation of it, or even deepen the foundation of it into the perception of unity, and that we're really 100%, it's not really 99% against 1%, and if we could do training, what I'm advocating is that Occupy really take a year off and don't place so much emphasis on protest for 1 year, and do a lot of training and reflection and community building, and then go back in with constructive wing and a protest wing. I think you would see what we sometimes call love in action. Love in action is a definition of nonviolence.
And Ted, if you could respond to that.
Yeah, sure. I think that we all agree that the main reason that we oppose the current system is precisely because it is violent. So anybody who's looking to overthrow it is inherently prefers nonviolence, as I certainly do, and I revile violence, and I've probably seen more of it than most people as a war correspondent. But that said, I think that there's a misunderstanding about what constitutes revolution. I mean, revolution is a wholesale change in the class structure. It is a replacement of one set of elites by another. It is about turning the people who are rich and powerful into people who are no longer rich or powerful, people who are poor and weak, and transforming those who are currently poor and weak into no longer poor and weak. And that process is not something, for instance, that people often mention India, which, by the way, the Indian independence movement was not a nonviolent struggle by any means. I mean, there was a lot of violence in it, in the buildup, and certainly in its immediate aftermath. But India was not a revolution. The wealthy remained wealthy. The poor remained poor. The caste system remained in place. It was not a wholesale transformation of society such as we've seen in France and Russia and China. Those were revolutions. India was an independent struggle, and that's just a completely different situation. If you're looking to topple the corporations and the executives and the super wealthy and the 1% who are running everything in this country, they are not going to relinquish their prerogatives and their power and their wealth voluntarily, or no matter how much we ask nicely, no matter how much we protest. That's just not going to happen. So if you believe, as I do, that these people have run the country and the planet into the ground, and that they're no longer should be trusted to run things, then you have to understand that ultimately, in the final analysis, we are going to have to resort to violence to drive them out of power. Believe me, nobody wishes more than I that that was not necessary. But history is very clear on this point. People will bring up, you know, the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa as an example of a movement that had elements of nonviolence. Again, not a revolution. After post-apartheid South Africa is a place where the people who were rich before remained rich, the poor remained poor. So I think that we really need to define our terms if we're going to talk about revolution. Revolution is not something that has ever taken place in a nonviolent context. It's just that revolutions are mostly nonviolent until the end.
We have about 3 minutes left. Several times in the show, we've had India invoked and the India of the colonial era. But I think it's important to add that there are nonviolent struggles going on in India today against the state's plans to build incredible dams along the Narmada River. And Arundhati Roy has been a powerful spokesperson in bringing awareness of that to the United States. One of the things she said in 2003, after the struggle of the Adivasi and the Dalit had been basically nullified by the Indian Supreme Court, she says, if we don't respect nonviolence, then violence becomes the only option for people. And she said that not, I think, as a threat or a basking in it, but as a kind of almost a desperate plea to the government that the government had to respect nonviolence. I wonder about that as it applies to the U.S. today. Are we faced with a government that does not respect nonviolent resistance?
Well, if if you're asking me, I think we are, but they can be made to respect it when they come to understand its power. This is something that's been repeated over and over again historically on the micro level, you know, among individuals and among big societies at large. And I think often when people are locked into a violent system, even as the oppressors, something inside them is looking for a way out. And it's the job of the nonviolent revolutionist, and I use the term a little bit differently from you, Ted. It's the job of a nonviolent revolutionist to give them a way out. And if you remember what Toynbee said about Gandhi, that he made it impossible for us to go on ruling India, but he made it possible for us to leave without rancor and without humiliation. And so while I completely agree with, I think we are all completely agreed with the analysis that an elite group has basically run the planet into the ground, for me, swapping this elite group with another elite group is not inspiring. I want to set up a world with a different set of values where elites will not use their power to oppress, but they'll look upon it as a kind of trusteeship, which was the cornerstone of Gandhi's economic program.
Abby Martin.
And yes, you're right. There are a lot of nonviolent movements going on in India, not only the Narmada Bacho Andolan, but the struggles in the South for landless workers, and been a great deal of success against Pepsi-Cola and against shrimp farming, all done by nonviolent work. And I see no reason why that couldn't build up to an entire regime change. And really what I want is an entire cultural change.
Abby Martin here. Just to wrap up the show, Ted, I wanted you to respond to Michael's plea for us taking a year to kind of step back and strategize and really create these nonviolent workshops. Do you think that we're running out of time, or do you agree that we need to kind of step back and re-strategize here?
I think both. You know, unfortunately, we are out of time. We've been out of time for decades. It's probably even too late. At this point, it's already a Hail Mary pass to try to change things. And that said, the Occupy movement is so not ready, completely not ready. It's so disorganized and haphazard, and I absolutely hear his plea to organize and train for actions that will be effective and will gain support. But I think, you know, what we really have to do at this point is recognize the reality that the situation is unraveling. The political system is being rapidly polarized from between left and right, and nobody can stop it at this point. And this is a revolutionary crisis moment. It is a time when really all the chips are down, and we are, and the planet and the country are in play, and nobody can stop it. And so at this point, all we can really do is do something that I called for in the Anti-American Manifesto, which sounded silly at the time, but it's essentially to form and organize a resistance force, an organization, while it's actually in the process of resisting. It's like learning how to drive a car while you're running alongside it. And we don't have any choice because we're out of time, and this is happening with or without us. No one can stop it.
Well, Ted and Michael, I think we're just about out of time here, but for people who are more interested in this conversation, certainly Ted Rawls' book, The Anti-American Manifesto, is available. I had it reading in my class last semester. My students really liked it a lot. But Michael Nagler's, as president of the Meta Center for Nonviolence, that's online. The readings there are incredible and extremely strong, and I encourage people to. This conversation must continue. This is but an hour that we talked about this today, and there's clearly a lot to be said about on you know, having a revolution and trying to keep it nonviolent as best we can. I think that's really important. And I think Ted's point, too, is that one of the points is that as we build revolution, we need to carry that forward and worry about where we're going. So I thank you both very much, and we're going to wrap that up. A couple of announcements tonight. Talking about revolution, Michael Parenti is going to be speaking on democracy and the pathology of wealth at 7:30. It's going to be at the La Peña Cultural Center on Shattuck Avenue. Also tomorrow night, Saturday night, the Occupy Wall Street, not Palestine. Omar Bhagati will be speaking at the First Presbyterian Church in Oakland at 7:30. So many things happening that it's impossible to kind of keep up as we follow through on this. Thank you very much. This is Pacifica Radio. This is KPFA 94.1, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. And thank you to our new affiliate, KBBF.